Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Fred Swan, wine writer and San Francisco Wine School educator, and your moderator for tonight's program. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, John Bonnet. John Bonnet is the wine editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, covering wine throughout Northern California and around the world. A winner of two James Beard Foundation Awards, he has also been a finalist for Best Wine Writing twice and has won several awards from the Association of Food Journalists. Previously, Bonnet was the lifestyle editor and wine columnist for MSNBC.com. He's also written about wine for numerous other publications, including Decanter, Civoir, Food and Wine, and The Art of Eating. Tonight, we're here to discuss Bonnet's latest book, The New California Wine, A Guide to Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste, which was published in 2013. Please join me in welcoming John Bonnet to the Commonwealth Club. So, John, I'd like to start out with some sort of general questions, get people acquainted with you. As a wine writer and a critic, what does that mean to you? What do you want to provide for your readers? How do you approach it?
First, Fred, an enormous thanks, as I said before, for helping be the other half of this the Dog and Pony Show tonight, and a thanks to everyone for coming out. Being a critic is interesting. You know, in the world of wine, the terms that sort of surround the people who put words into what once was paper and is now paper and digital and whatever other forms, is a little fudgy. There are a lot of people who sort of are wine writers, and that's tough because that implies telling a story, but ultimately, if you're going to, and I struggled with this for a long time, if you're going to be writing about wine, you have to be a critic, and I mean that not in the sense of I give this a 95 because I can dance to it, but in the way that Robert Hughes was really probably the greatest art critic of the 20th century, which is you have to figure out how to shine a light not simply on what you like and what you don't, but also on the larger patterns that you see around you and the ways in which whatever you're criticizing, in my case, obviously wine, is contributing to the larger culture. And for me, that's more often than not what gets lost with wine criticism, in part because modern wine criticism has really been built up on this, you know, this system of just assigning scores and walking on, which isn't fundamentally bad, but doesn't really get you to larger questions of culture, questions of farming, questions of sustainability. And to me, if you're going to be really diligent and serious as a critic, that's what you have to do. You have to hit all of that.
Now, you grew up in New York, tasting probably mostly European wines that were
and a lot of California.
Okay, with your father. So, how did that upbringing, tasting wines with your dad, how did that shape your palate and? And what sort of expectations does that leave you with when you go about tasting a wine?
I think the benefit, I guess you could say, is, you know, most wine writers, wine critics have this transformation story. One day they were drinking beer, drinking Coca-Cola, and then they had this glass of wine that changed their life, and ever after that they had to pursue truth and beauty. And I just never had that. But for me, the net benefit was that wine was always in a context. It was never this lofty, elevated thing. It was just this thing that was a part of a cultured life and a part of a gastronomic life. So my father was also trained as a chef, so he was running kind of a gourmet foods and catering business. And so just, you know, when I wasn't mostly unhappy about being the woefully underpaid child labor in the basement, packing gift baskets, the you know, wine was just a piece of it. And so I honestly forgot about wine as a serious thing for a long time. And so by the time I came back to it, it wasn't fetishized for me. And I think ultimately that's ended up being really helpful, because I had a few years where I, you know, was incredibly dazzled by supposedly fancy and fantastic wines, but relatively quickly it became clear that you have to sort out the supposition of greatness from what's actually great, and so. You know, to me, that gave me a leg up, but it doesn't give me a very good story on why I became a wine critic.
You mentioned food and your father's business. When you're reviewing a wine, how much do you think about that wine or those wines in the context of food, something that would go with a meal? I don't mean like specific pairings, but just in general, how much is sort of fitness for the dinner table something you think about?
Always. I mean, anyone who sort of follows the wines that I like and the wines that I don't, it's generally pretty evident that I do not give a whole lot of credence to wines that want to stand up and be heard on their own. And that's my bias, and it's one I've kind of comfortably owned. I think if you are, you can be so impressed by a wine that maybe you're not thinking about it in the context of, well, this would really go great with this particular dish, but I think if you take it out of that context, then you've lost, you know, 50% at least of the cultural value of wine, which is to be on the table.
And then when you sit down to taste a wine for review, what are you looking for? What's the difference between a wine you're going to recommend and one you don't recommend, and how much of that decision may be based on style as opposed to other specifics of the wine?
For better or worse, I can usually figure out whether I'm going to recommend a wine in about 20 seconds. And some of that's just you do it enough that it becomes really clear. You know, the style, at some point I'll sort of check myself and say, is this a style I like? Is this a style I don't? But is this a style that to me is true to itself and made purely and succeeding in all of the ways that it should, again, with the notion that wine sort of still has to function on the table and as part of sort of a larger cultural context. And so a big $300 low-acid Napa Cabernet that was clearly tinkered with to high heaven, that may succeed for its style, but the style itself is so questionable in that it's, you know, it's made for sheer artifice and to impress really basically two palates, not mine, that's that point where I sort of take a critic's prerogative and just say, this thing sucks. But in general, you know, I will know pretty fast if I think a wine is recommendable or not. And then I'll kind of go back through my little sort of vague checklist and say, you know, is the alcohol showing? Is the fruit complete from beginning to end? Where is it in its life? Is it from a ripe vintage and maybe more dominant with fruit and not quite showing its full level of nuance? I've gotten a couple of irate emails from other critics who feel like I ding vintages that they like because I think they're simplistic and they think I just don't understand. And I have yet to see myself proven wrong on this, but that's thus the whims of taste. But, you know, I guess the way I would put it is that I want to make sure all the sort of benchmarks for what should be a good or a great wine are being hit. But then I also want to understand a wine's gestalt, if you will, that I want to understand why that wine exists. And I think some of the wines that we'll be able to taste a little bit later, they're wines that to me are good under any circumstance, but I think it really also is important with some of them to understand the context in which they were made, which isn't an apology for flawed wine, but is to me a defense of wine that doesn't fall into this very simplistic flavor matrix that I think we've been burdened with for about 15 years, where if it doesn't hit you over the head, then it is by default somehow lesser.
So speaking of that, you came to California in 2006 to take a job with the Chronicle as the wine editor. What was your impression of California wine in general? What was sort of the broad brush impression of California wines when you got here?
It was really difficult when I got here. It was the nadir, I guess, of what in the book I call the era of big flavor, which is to say it was a time when, again, critical pressures had really forced people to make much bigger, much flashier, much more impact-driven wines. And that was that had already sort of been well underway since about 1997. So by 2006, it was, you know, the late decadent part of that era. And just, you know, it was really hard to find wines that were speaking to me, not only in the context from having come from the East Coast, but also the context of having been in Seattle for 6 years before that and really coming to love Washington wines, which are certainly not shrinking violets, but you know, maintain both nuance and power. And also the California wines that I had remembered really loving from, you know, an era that, you know, was not actually that much earlier. Really up until about the early to mid-90s. So coming out here, it was this. I had this existential moment where I sort of decided that I had to look for the people who I thought were still doing good work and frankly, holding California up to the best that it could be.
Yeah, you mentioned big flavor, which is that concept certainly plays a big role in your book. And I think you've explained it a little bit, but I think a lot of people that I've spoken to don't maybe get sort of the nuance in there, and they say, well, John says all kinds of nice things about Turley and Kongsgaard, and those wines are rich and ripe and have huge flavor. What's the difference?
The difference is nuance. And I would say even the most gaudy of the Turley wines have always still, one had impeccable vineyard provenance and had, they came from vines that frankly had the stuffing to make an interesting wine no matter how it was made. But I think, you know, those wines are absolutely powerful and they should be and they're designed to be. But they demonstrate a level of complexity. They lead with the intrinsic values of the fruit and the vineyards that those that fruit comes from, and they're for better or worse made again largely without artifice. They're not. I mean, those are two very good examples because the winemaking both at Turley and at Kongsgaard is notably minimalistic, almost 19th century minimalistic. Indigenous yeasts. You know, John uses a fair amount of new oak, but he also has such incredible concentration in his Chardonnay that, kind of like with the best Montrachet, you can do that. You know, long times in barrel, not a lot of work, not a lot of stirring of lees. In John's case, it's, you know, it's the famous death and resurrection, where essentially the wine has to go dead, it has to go mute for about a year, and then eventually it starts to come back, and it's just this question of perfection through neglect, and so yeah, you know, there's big flavor was an interesting linguistic twist because in, you know, on one hand it represents this thing that people think that they should like. But in fact, it's this kind of heavy-handed approach to making a wine of impact, rather than understanding that you might have found a vineyard and a context in which you can make a wine of impact, because that's what the vineyard gives you.
Now, moving to the book specifically, as well, just curious, what is it that drove you to write that particular book? And what audience did you have in mind when you did that? Who were you speaking to?
But I never really thought about an audience. I figured people who might have loved California wine at some point, or who might love it now, or who might have completely taken no interest or stopped having an interest, as sort of a vague overall audience. I think it was simply realizing, in the context, as you were saying when I came out here, of being a little bit despondent, that, you know, so the first maybe 2 or 3 years that I was here was this process of hunting down people who would, you know, who were fighting the good fight, and that, I mean, these are all folks who show up in the book, but I showed up, and of course, about 2 weeks after I walked into the newsroom of the Chronicle, I had to pick a winemaker of the year. No pressure. And so my first winemaker of the year was Paul Draper at Ridge, which was sort of this obvious choice, because Paul had been such a defender of really the intrinsic beauty of California wine for so long. And the next year it was Josh Jensen of Calera, and so it was this process of looking for people who I felt were still interested in upholding the full potential of California. And then around 2009, I'd started writing about some folks who you might call emergent, a guy named Abe Scherner, who has a winery called the Scolium Project, which is now just about a fully commercial venture, but at the time you could maybe say it was semi-experimental. It was kind of like an art project, but with barrels. And guys named Duncan Myers and Nathan Roberts, who were two friends who grew up in Napa together, and decided that they wanted to make wines from California out of a sheer sense of California pride, that represented the wines, that represented what they loved, which at that point was a lot of Austrian reds and Loire wines and what have you, and they felt that they should be able to show wines with the same amount of sort of intrinsic charm, but that had the sunshine of California. And so kept finding these people, and by about 2010, it was really clear that that, you know, it wasn't just me searching, that there were a lot of people who were actually out there making wine who weren't happy, or who were equally as dissatisfied as I was, and wanted a different context. And from there, it was just kind of a long 3 years of actually getting all the stuff to put in a book.
You know, when I've talked to people that are industry insiders and other writers and that kind of thing, a few of them have looked at the book and, you know, said, well, you know, of course this and that, and, you know, I know about these people. But to me, the book is an excellent overview on the California wine industry, the history of California wine, and it really talks about wines that people outside of California, certainly, and even a lot of consumers in California have never heard of. And it is a new style in a way, or a new approach to winemaking that is very different from with the common stereotypes about California wine. So something else that's been mentioned to me, and you've touched on these guys a little bit. So people see the title, The New California Wine, and then they flip in there, and some of the first names they see are you know,
are the old California,
are the old guys. Can you explain how they fit into the new California wine?
Sure. I mean, what became very clear as I was starting to work on it was that one direction I could go would be to just make it really sort of this new young generation, and essentially here's the hipsters of California. And that pretty quickly didn't appeal to me, only in that I felt if you were going to tell the story, if I was going to tell the story of how California wine has gotten to this inflection point that I think it's in now, you had to understand that it wasn't simply coming from nowhere, that if anything, it was this reappearance of the same beliefs, the same values, the same quality that had really shown up in the late 60s and early 70s, this first golden era of modern California wine, when the Warren Vinyarskis and the Robert Mondavis, the Paul Drapers, the Josh Jensens were all sort of starting to show up. And we're working in this context where Unlike now, when California wine's really pretty famous, at that point, California was jug wine. It was table wine, fortified, and they were suddenly addressing this prospect that what at the time was almost entirely an old world benchmark, that they could not only meet it but surpass it. And obviously in 1976 at the Judgment of Paris, when California swept the French, that was sort of the exclamation point. But it was a long period of work, really sort of more than anything I'd say through the early to mid 70s, of making the case for California's greatness. And so for me, looking at how in some ways that had happened again, there was no way to do that without talking about the full circle nature of it.
So speaking of full circle, you have a quote in the beginning of the book, which you know I'm fond
Arpad.
Of. Yeah, yeah. If you don't mind, I'm going to read that for the folks and then let you tell them who said it and when. The people who are experimenting are not generally found among the large growers, but are more likely discovered among the hills and retired nooks in the counties nearest the bay. I find that they have worked cautiously. Most of them are men of small property and limited means and do the greater part of the work themselves. I think that the finest wines of the state will eventually be found to have been made by this class of viticulturalists. They have time and they use it properly. They have ambition and they follow it. They do not reckon their time at so many dollars an hour. Very likely, it will require some length of time before their products are appreciated, but the time will come either in their lives or in those of their children following. I know several people, the exact counterpart of those above described, and believe them the forerunners of a new era of winemaking in our state. So, John, who said that and when was that?
So that was Arpad Horasti, who was the son of Agustin Horasti, who was one of the fathers of California wine in the 1850s and 60s. He founded Buena Vista. He didn't really bring Zinfandel over, but certainly took credit for it. But did actually bring over quite a lot of plant material and really built certainly Sonoma's and beyond winemaking culture. Arpad was his son, had perhaps a slightly more commercial interest. There's admittedly, that quote may be just a touch self-serving. I think it was in 1892.
Yeah.
So the new California has been being new for a long time, over and over again. But it was interesting because in a completely pre-prohibition context, even at that point, it was very clear that there was going to be this intrinsic tension between the commercialization and the industrialization of wine, and really the pursuit of greatness on a human scale.
So speaking of cycles and styles in winemaking, Chardonnay, by sales volume, is easily America's favorite wine, favorite variety. And if you look at California Chardonnay, in 1969, it was very little of it planted. It really didn't start taking off until the early 70s. Then in the early 80s, at Kendall Jackson, they created a style that sort of took the world by storm, and we went into the buttery, oaky, slightly sweet phase. And we've gone through a few things since then. So where do you see California Chardonnay today, and where do you see it going?
Yeah, my interesting tidbit with Chardonnay, as you alluded to, yeah, it's in 1962, in the early 60s, there were fewer than 100 acres of what at the time was being called Pinot Chardonnay, and there's now 100,000. So someone must like making Chardonnay or see some just a little bit of money in it. Where I think it is now is actually in an extraordinary place, because there was the rise of this very buttery kind of pro forma Chardonnay that people liked for a while and then hated. And so what rose out of that was sort of this completely austere style of Chardonnay. If anyone remembers the ABC, the Anything But Chardonnay era, which some people believe is still going. So what rose out of that was these stainless steel, un-oaked Chardonnays, which were interesting in a way, but were sort of chasing the wrong ideal in the sense that they were often austere. They were, I dare to use the word joyless, but they didn't really show a whole lot, in part because the winemaking was this very kind of technical, you know, put it in steel, block everything, keep it cold, and make it this kind of, you know, thin, wispy wine. That's exactly what the big buttery Chardonnay wasn't. So we're now in what I call the third wave, which is somewhere in between the two. The people who are making really good Chardonnay are doing it in slightly elusive and complex ways. They are often using oak, but frequently it's not new. They are putting it through malolactic fermentation, which tends to soften the wine and enrich it, but not in an ostentatious way, in a way that often you can't tell. I did this kind of Chardonnay intensive for a bunch of Masters of Wine last year, and they actually couldn't pick out the wines that had gone through mallow in a lot of cases, because there were wines that, you know, had gone through it but were still so sort of fresh and high in acid that it wasn't detectable. There were wines that hadn't gone through it that had a lot of body. And so the nice part is that the really good Chardonnays out of that 100,000 acres, a lot fewer than 100,000 acres, but are on great soils, are making really compelling wines, and really do credit to that grape, not only, I think, in a California context, but in a global context. Because I think if you, I don't even think, having gone through these tastings, if you put really the best of modern, meaning new, California Chardonnay up against great Meursault, great Chablis, even, you know, great Corton Charlemagne, they absolutely hold their own. And that to me is, you know, not to say that we should just be sort of benchmarking against the French, but I think that they really are establishing themselves as some of the great white wines of the world.
Now, Chardonnay is considered a neutral white grape variety in that it's not overtly floral, over-the-top fruity, and it does benefit, as you said, from some time in oak to gain complexity and sort of express itself. Another grape in that category is one that you're pretty excited about these days, but it's right now it's kind of sitting where Chardonnay was 40 years ago or so. That's Chenin Blanc. Can you talk about what's going on with that?
Yeah, Chenin is having this great little revival, and again, folks with long memories, probably even longer than mine, will recall that, you know, in the 80s, Chenin Blanc was still a very favored variety for people to buy when they were sort of starting to think about varietal wines, that most significant wineries bottled a Chenin Blanc of some sort, and it was exactly what it should be. It was this fresh, kind of peachy, apple-y, you know, sometimes dry, sometimes off-dry, which, of course, if you can't make up your mind between those two, that's the kiss of death for any grape. But they were really interesting wines, and then they eventually became associated with kind of, you know, low-grade wine, low-grade winemaking. Most of the serious white winemakers moved on to Chardonnay and let Chenin Blanc go. And so it's been interesting the past even couple years that, again, there's really serious white winemakers who have gone back, have looked for some older vines, either in Clarksburg or down in Santa Barbara. There's one vineyard down there called Jurassic Park, which is an unforgettable name, that's 35-year-old dry-farmed Chenin Blanc vines. That there's this little cluster of really talented winemakers who've all kind of gotten fruit out of there. And it's a grape that actually does well by exactly what California can do, which is a good bit of sunshine and a good bit of heat. And it's not actually a Loire context, which is what people tend to think. If you look at, say, South Africa's Swartland, or even, you know, places elsewhere in Europe where occasionally you'll find Chenin Blanc, it is a grape that can withstand heat and still make a really interesting, intense, mineral-edged wine. And I think we're getting back to that point where California is showing that, you know, yet another strength.
Alcohol percentages in wine is something that's a hot topic these days and subject to debate, at least among wine critics and sommeliers and whatnot. I'm not sure how much consumers actually care or talk about it, but certainly some do. There seem to be reviewers that the richer the wine, in, to some degree, almost the higher the alcohol, the better they like it. There are others at the opposite of the spectrum where they're constantly looking for things below 14 or even below 13%. And then there are some in the middle who talk about balance and it's all about appropriateness for a given wine. Where do you fall in that, and what are your thoughts on the debate as overall?
Well, I was the guy who managed to get the Chronicle to start printing alcohol levels in 2011. So I think it's important. I don't think it defines a wine by any means, but I think that it has to be somewhere in the conversation. And it's interesting. I thought when we did it that we would get a fair amount of reader pushback, but readers on balance have absolutely loved it. And I actually think there are a lot of wine drinkers who do think about it in some way. The only people who were really upset by it, not surprisingly, were about two or three critics who didn't like that that it made it a little bit easier to see where their own palate biases were, and winemakers who, frankly, had been pushing a lot of high-alcohol wine out the door and hoping that none of us would notice. I mean, wine with an excess of alcohol frustrates me, mostly because I don't think it needs to usually be as high as it is. But that said, you know, there's plenty of wine in the book. I mean, we covered the two perfect examples, Kongsgaard and Turley. Turley rarely makes a Zinfandel under 15%, and that's a pretty honest 15%. It's just that's where the grape expresses itself. Having started my day, this is embarrassing, having started my day flying back from New York on a flight that I have been doing some work with JetBlue on selecting wines, and literally at the equivalent of about 7:05 Pacific time, I was tasting a Turley Zinfandel at 35,000 feet. I don't recommend starting your day this way. But, you know, I mean, it's the Turley 13 Juvenile. It's 15.2, 15.5. Doesn't come across that way at all. Beautifully balanced, even when you're in, you know, flying at 500 miles an hour through the air and your palate is exposed to excesses, the wine is absolutely in balance. And I think when people can succeed making a wine like that, that's great. The problem is that more often than not, they don't. And it's not the logical fault is that that's where the wine naturally expresses itself, which is more often than not the defense that winemakers give. My rebuttal to that would be that's where the wine expresses itself when you need to get 94 points. And that's the system that has been driving me crazy, has been driving a lot of winemakers who don't necessarily subscribe to that style of winemaking, but have felt they had to give into it in some way. That's what drives them crazy. And I think when high impact is a less big part of the conversation of wine criticism and of success, then we'll stop talking about alcohol so much.
Before we stop talking about that entirely, so another one of America's most popular wines, and certainly the highest value wines that we tend to put out, are Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. And that's not necessarily a wine that people see you review a whole lot of or recommend a whole lot of or associate with you, but there are some Napa Valley Cabs that you love. Can you talk a little bit about what some of those are and what distinguishes those?
Sure. And to be candid, the reason I don't review Napa Cabernet that much is that they're really expensive. And there's nothing wrong with an expensive wine, and certainly if it's going to be a significant, serious wine that you want for the cellar and you want you want to have a life ahead and you want to buy it and enjoy it as a special thing, that's great. But the problem is that every single person, it's like Lake Wobegon. Everyone thinks that their child's above average. You know, every single person who makes Napa Cabernet thinks they make the most awesome Cabernet there is. And within that, there are, you know, quite a lot of extraordinary Cabernets. Just thinking sort of straight top of my head, I think if you look at the Dominus wines, which typically, by the way, tend to land around 14.8, they are some of the greatest Cabernet-based wines produced anywhere in the world, including Bordeaux. And I think when you taste them in parallel with even first growth Bordeaux, you see the quality that's there. I think the wines at Spotswood are always extraordinary. Again, this perfect snapshot of a benchland Cabernet, not a modest wine either. The counterpart to that being the Coruscant wines, which, you know, Kathy has a very different view about alcohol. She always wants it under 14% one way or the other. And from really very similar land comes up with wine that has both a commonality of the Western Napa benchland, but also a totally different expression. I think Steve Mathiasen's red wines, Steve gets a lot of credit for his whites, but his red wines, often as much Merlot-based as Cabernet, are extraordinary. And Steve's the guy who really puts the lie to the ripeness issues in Cabernet because, you know, he's a viticulturist for people like Araujo Isley, which again has been an exceptional example. And if he fundamentally believes and can prove that you can pick right Cabernet at 23.5 bricks, it's somewhat hard to dispute him. And there's others. I mean, just to throw one more in, the Snowden wines, which are really not that well known and I wish were better known, are exceptional wines. And to the point of ripeness, those often land somewhere around 15%. And those are made by Diana Snowden Sess, who's sort of the winemaking star within that family, which has had land in Napa since at least the 50s, I think since before that. Diana's also married to Jeremy Sess, whose family has Domaine Dujac in Burgundy, so when she's not making 15% Napa Cabernet, she's making Grand Cru Burgundy. And what comes through is the sense of finesse, especially with tannins, that that really, I think, separates out someone who is masterful at finding the best expression that Napa can offer.
Let's step back and talk about the book specifically for a second. It's not organized in the same way that many wine books are, where it's sort of front to back, appellation by appellation, region by region, or variety by variety, or even just, you know, these are all the great wineries in alphabetical order. I found it a very enjoyable sort of regular book-like experience to read through it, but it's not, the sort of alphabetical reference type tome that people might expect. Can you talk about that and why you set it up the way you did and how you hope people use it?
Well, that's a better response than one of our writing colleagues who called it inscrutable. So thank you. In terms of the structure, and the structure is basically in three parts. Part one is a narrative, part two is kind of a road trip, and part three is reference by variety, approximately. It started out being two parts. Part one was going to be the narrative, part two was going to be the reference, and the narrative was important because, again, to that point of what a critic does, maybe half the job is actually finding the wines and talking about what's good, and that's ultimately where the reference part comes in. But the other part is to step back and find the themes that help people to understand why certain wines matter and why what people do in the field matters. And there was so much that I felt hadn't really been explored in terms of why California went through this weird period, the big flavor period, but what were the circumstances that had led to that? What were the circumstances that dictated farming for better or worse? You know, how were we creating a wine culture, having, you know, survived the scar of Prohibition, and what was really defining California wine culturally. So I knew that the narrative part needed to be in there. The middle part came when what was originally supposed to be my chapter on terroir hit about 25,000 words, and my editor said, "I think this probably needs to be a separate section." That was the unplanned part, but it ended up, in a way, that's actually kind of my favorite part of the book, because it's the one with the strongest. I mean, the narrative part obviously has a narrative, but the road trip has a momentum to it, and I think was a chance to take everyone along on all these weird, crazy trips that I had to do in order to do the reporting, and in part to go to some very little known places. I mean, it's no surprise the folks in Napa are not hugely happy that there's no Napa chapter, although Napa is everywhere in that book. But there was no story to tell. I mean, its story is known, and unfortunately, there's not as much innovation there as I would hope, and so there just never needed to be one. But yeah, it's It was, I guess, trying to please all masters.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Fred Swan, wine writer and San Francisco Wine School educator, and your moderator this evening. Our guest tonight is San Francisco Chronicle's wine editor, John Binet, discussing his book, The New California Wine. John, your top 100 list for the San Francisco Chronicle just came out. Can you tell us how you go about deciding which wines actually get into a top 100 and how much overlap there is in wines from one year to the next?
Not entirely sure about the overlap. Maybe 20 to 30%, something like that. I never actually have run the numbers, mostly because by the time I've gotten the list out, I don't want to see it again ever. In terms of how I come up with it, it's based first and foremost in the tastings that I'm doing throughout the year, and that gives me sort of the baseline. And then somewhere around the 1st of September, we send a very discouraging reminder to wineries that says in every way possible, you really don't want to send us wine. And then we get about 1,000 cases of wine show up. So then I sort of go through that and look for the wines that I think are potentially stand a chance of being in contention, and then I'm tasting for the better part of 2 months every day, and out of all of that, which ranges but somewhere between 3,000 and 6,000 wines in the course of the year. I come down to a list. The first cut is always around 200, 225, and I cut that again to about 175, and then 150, and then 120, and then it starts getting really hard. And somewhere around November 15th, November 18th, I'll have about 105 wines, and then I have to figure out who gets coal in their stocking. And so eventually, I look at the numbers, look at the distribution, check which wines are current, which of course they never are. I'm always missing the exact vintage that I need. But sort of doing due diligence on everything that's out there, seeing if there's any that just, are really good, but are, a little bit too difficult, and figuring out how the numbers balance. So like this year, for instance, last year I think we had 8 rosés, and this year I might have had 2, and it was nothing about rosés in particular except that the 12s were a slightly stronger crop, and I had a lot of other things. I wanted to get in some small production sparkling wines, because those are just starting to really make an appearance on the West Coast, and after years and years where, we were all talking about the same names over and over again, it was worth acknowledging that there's great artisanship there. To your point about Chenin Blanc, Chenin was kind of the sleeper hit of the white wines, where I think there's 6 or 8 Chenins in the list, which has never happened before. So it's It's kind of this 4-month process of haggling with myself.
You touched on sparkling wine, and there's a question from the audience about that. Maybe you can talk to us about the state of sparkling wine in California in general, and where you see some of these new emerging regions coming out with sparkling, and who's doing a really good job.
Sure. Sparkling is really interesting because for a long time, I mean, with the exception of Schramsberg, which was obviously wholly sprouted from California. I mean, the Davies were from Southern California to begin with, and then took on this historic property. There have not been a ton of really indigenous sparkling wines, if you will. Iron Horse would be another, although I wish the quality there was where it had been a few years ago. But for the most part, most of the sparkling wines in California were directly born out of the Champagne houses. Roederer, Mumm, Domaine Carneros, which is Tétinger, Chandon, et cetera, you know, Maison Dutz, which is no longer with us, it's now Letitia. But really, the modern era of sparkling wine in California was basically the Champenois coming over and getting land that they could actually afford, since Champagne does not offer that anymore. And which was fine, but ultimately I think gave a reputation for it being kind of the little brothers of Champagne. Of them all, and I say this in the book, Roederer has always been the ones that I felt were the most committed to really understanding what, in their case, Anderson Valley terroir could be and making a wine that had its own context. So that was sort of, that defined the better part of California sparkling wine history since, let's say, 1966. And then what's happened the past few years is that a lot of younger winemakers have either looked to what's happening in Champagne, which is that the growers in Champagne, who traditionally were always selling to the large houses, have really taken on the market and wanted to make wines that were specific to their place, their village, their vineyard, wanted to make them at a much smaller scale and wanted to show that Champagne as a wine should have terroir, should have specificity, should have craft. And so what we're seeing now is the exact same thing, but obviously in an American context, where people want to find great, interesting vineyards and express them, in their case, through sparkling wine. Thinking just offhand, there's a very small project called Under the Wire, which is in part from Morgan Twain Peterson, who has a winery called Bedrock, which you may or may not have heard of. Most people have probably heard of his father's winery, which is Ravenswood. And so when Joel sold Ravenswood, that gave them the latitude to do some work. So Morgan, in addition to making a lot of Zinfandel, he and his friend Chris Cottrell decided they wanted to do basically grower champagne from California. So they got Hirsch, they got Brusso, they got Alder Springs. These are all sort of prime Pinot Noir and Chardonnay vineyards, and they made sparkling versions of each of them. So we're just starting to see the first of these really show up, and even just this year. But I think in the next few years, you're going to see, as the infrastructure builds, that sparkling wine just is still is getting more artisanal, more small scale, and really moving away from this kind of big champagne model that California, you know, I would say copied, but it wasn't even that it was copied, because it was the Champenois coming over here and really replicating what they had done on their home turf.
And I think we're used to most of California's high quality sparkling wines coming out of the North Coast, but there's really sort of a growing current of people with small production down in Santa Barbara County area working on sparkling now, because they've got some really good cool climate areas for Pinot and Chardonnay. And about this time last year, I was hanging out at the vineyard in Bien Nacido, and the guys from McPrice Meyer and Paso Robles showed up, and we're looking at the grapes they were going to use for sparkling. So that's definitely an area to look at also. There's some good stuff down there. Wine critics seem to get criticized for something that critics in other fields do not. Nobody complains that when Ben Fong Torres or whoever talks about a concert or a CD that he knows who was producing the music. Roger Ebert always knew who made the movie he was watching. Michael Bauer knows what restaurant he's in. But somehow, and even Consumer Reports, which is supposed to be this unbiased consumer testing agency, knows exactly what they're testing. Somehow wine critics are often told that they need to taste blind or they don't have any credibility. Can you talk about the issue of blind tasting in wine?
The interesting thing with blind tasting, and I should say I taste a combination of blind and non-blind, and blind tasting can be useful if you want to look at like wines in a similar context, but they are, to me, actually, it's not a terribly useful process for assessing quality within the scope of somebody's overall set of work. Blind tasting has one very powerful proponent. It happens to be a magazine, and they have spent they seem to be spending most of their days on Twitter defending blind tasting and chastising every other critic for not doing it. The only problem with that is that the single most successful wine critic in history, which is Robert Parker, and The Advocate, which is his publication, hasn't tasted blind for about 20 years, and nobody cares. Literally, nobody cares. There's probably some winemakers who are a little pissy about it, but on balance, they're not really, because they'd rather that that what Bob typically has done and now his other writers have done is they show up and they taste and they want to set a context. And I think that's actually, to their enormous credit, that's the way they've decided they want to do it, rather than sitting in a room with a bunch of paper bags. You know, there's probably some winemakers who are pissy. There's, like I said, there's some wine critics who have decided that blind tasting gives them this kind of faux objectivity that defend it. But all of the critics you mentioned come to the task of their criticism with their own biases. They've owned them, and they would certainly argue that they're giving people a fair shot, but I don't think that they would argue that they're sitting objectively on high. And yet somehow in wine criticism, there's this slightly delusional belief that if you presume to take the bias out, that you can come up with this objective perception of quality. And I think it's just ridiculous. And ultimately, a critic will stand or fall based on the quality of their criticism. And again, like I said, you know, if you look at whatever my other issues with Robert Parker, and if you read the book, you will see they are manifest. But one of the things that has been interesting and informative to me is that his success has been built on absolutely not tasting blind. And he has, I think, some of the most talented critics in the world now working for him who are also not tasting blind. And I think that they're providing fantastic context.
It seems like it's also an American controversy to some extent. I mean, I think if you went to, or a critic went to Burgundy and told them that he wanted to taste the wines blind, he'd probably be run out of town in a hurry.
They do. I mean, the British certainly have a fondness for tasting blind in some circumstances. Neil Martin, actually, who's now The Advocate's critic for Burgundy, was just there tasting blind at the Hospice de Beaune by appellation, because he wanted to see within, say, Haute Côte de Beaune or Volnay, what have you. He wanted to benchmark it blind, more out of curiosity as an intellectual exercise. They had no real problems with it. You know, I think in some ways it's born out of yes, what is an American insecurity with wine culture and with feeling that we know enough to be confident in our tastes. But I also think that even within the past 3-5 years, that not just like, you know, wine geeky people, but everyone has made some quantum leaps in feeling more comfortable and in feeling like this is legitimately a part of our culture now.
Paso Robles AVA was just recently divided into many because it had been the largest AVA in California. They didn't have any smaller appellations within it, and there were some really extreme differences in rainfall, temperature, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that in general, or the AVA process, the creation of new AVAs? And then also, what are your thoughts on where Paso Robles stands today?
I think the Paso subdivision was one of the better ones, only because it was such a fraught process that they had the time to make some good decisions. And you know, of whatever it is, the 13, 11 subdivisions, you know, maybe four of them are going to really turn out to make true quality wine. But I think if if it gives people the chance to talk about what people who've been interested in Paso have talked about for a while, which is the Templeton Gap being different from the Adelaida area, being different from Willow Creek, although when you look at the gerrymandering of those borders, you can see that it is functionally impossible to take politics out of the appellation process. But, you know, if that gives people a better language to talk about not just Paso, but interesting places within this kind of huge, sprawling blanket of an AVA, that's great. My larger issue is that the way that the American appellation system is set up is, one, doesn't really place a premium on quality. And this is not to say it should be the way the French are, where you're mandating farming, you're mandating yields, you're mandating what grapes you can use. But it's all it really does is basically guarantee a boundary on a map, which may or may not be a useful boundary. And so that's fine, but it's mostly just kind of a marketing proposition. And especially, and this is my real issue with the ABA system, is it's no longer fashionable to do the hard work and figure out where there's really great terroir and there's really great land. And then once you've found a place or an area that's really special, to say, you know what, we want, you know, the equivalent of landmark status. We want to enshrine this in a way that makes sure that this thing that we've really worked hard on is going to have some standards to make sure that there's promises about origin. Now people just file for it even if there's no vineyards in the appellation. You know, you see these 40,000 acre appellations with the two vineyards in them, and there's nothing to slow that process down, except for the fact that the federal government sort of sneered at people for a while and threatened to stop approving them. But we're back to exactly where we were. So I like that there's a push for specificity and a push for geography. Anything that makes people think about geography makes me happy. But I also see these things get approved that have no context to pretty much anyone who doesn't live within the boundaries of those appellations.
What up-and-coming appellations or unsung appellations would you like to sing? What's got you excited these days in terms of emerging regions in California?
It's always tricky because nothing ever seems as emerging to me as it probably is. Obviously, the Sonoma Coast, the quote-unquote true Sonoma Coast, which is the part that's actually coastal and not sort of all the way by Carneros. But again, that's been sort of a known quantity for a long time. I think the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is in no way a new or even emerging appellation, is finally really getting some attention, and specifically not just sort of the Shendor, which is where Martin Ray and now Mount Eden and Ridge and so on, which is farther north, but the Corralitos-Aptos area, which is sort of the northern end of Monterey Bay, which has, again, is not new. It's had plantings for 30 or 40 years, but I think it's just being rediscovered for the quality potential that it has. I think there's interesting parts of the Central Coast that probably fall a little bit outside of the current boundaries. Like I was saying with Paso, you know, Templeton Gap is really interesting, but I think that's only part of it, because if you keep moving farther west out toward the ocean, again, you get this real sort of undiscovered boundary coastal area. I think there's parts of the Santa Rita Hills down in Santa Barbara that are really starting to emerge as extraordinary. But again, they're often sort of the ones at the western fringe. And to the point about Appalachians, there's an Appalachian where they're now having this massive, nasty battle about the eastern expansion of the Santa Rita Hills, because basically someone's got a vineyard they want inside the boundary instead of out. But what's interesting to me is they're having this enormous fight over that, and yet they're completely unwilling to talk about the fact that that is an Appalachian with two totally separate valleys, totally separate soil types. They make completely different wines, and they have totally different quality levels. And, you know, it's convenient to fight about geography when you don't want somebody else in your neighborhood, but when your house might get devalued, it's funny how you don't want to talk about it. And I think the other one I'd throw in there is the Sierra foothills, and especially El Dorado. I think after a long time of people not really paying attention, there's a quality of wine coming out of there, and especially the Rhone varieties on granitic soils that are up there are starting to really, really show how good they can be.
So Pinot Noir kind of took off in a massive way a number of years ago, right around the time that the movie Sideways came out, not entirely as a result of that combination of things. But where do you see Pinot Noir today? It's expanded so much. Is it in danger of becoming Merlot because there's so much going into areas that aren't suitable? And where's the good stuff, and what do you think about Pinot overall?
It's that danger of destroying what it is you love. It's interesting because the common story is that Sideways was the best thing to ever happen to Pinot Noir. I actually think it was the worst thing to ever happen to Pinot Noir, in that it gave this presumption that Pinot Noir was just another grape that you could make. And it's of all the red grapes, possibly excepting a couple others, it's the one that does not respond well to mass production. And so there's this enormous number of folks who I don't want to say duped, I think that's probably too strong a word, but have been led to believe that Pinot Noir is something which in fact it is not. And you will not find a context historically in which Pinot Noir has ever been a grape that tolerated production on a large scale. So you have all of these Pinots that don't really taste like Pinot Noir. At the same time, you have, I think, the quality level of Pinot Noir better at its pinnacle than it's ever been in this country. In terms of where, I mean, we ran through most of them: Far Sonoma Coast, Santa Cruz Mountains, Santa Rita Hills, Anderson Valley up in Mendocino. I think if I was gonna, those would be kind of the strong four in terms of just the sheer number of exceptional wines that are generated from those places, and just having that sweet spot. But again, I mean, even within Anderson Valley, if you keep going west outside the Appalachian, you guys should talk to Brian and Jennifer about this, because they know that terrain better than I do. But you keep heading west toward the ocean, and you find these great Pinot Noir vineyards that sit outside the boundary lines, that are essentially sort of Mendocino's equivalent of the Far Sonoma Coast. And almost no one understands them because it just, the geography wasn't convenient for people to embrace. What's going to happen is that Malbec is going to become the new Pinot Noir, which became the new Merlot. And then maybe Pinot can go back to being itself.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one more question. So, John, what trends are you seeing now that you look forward to seeing develop? Maybe things you're seeing from the top 100 you've just done, some Cab Franc things or whatever else. What should we look for next year?
We covered a good bunch of them. Chenin Blanc, you know, Pinot being Pinot again, sparkling wine. Yeah, I think Cabernet Franc has finally hit its own inflection point where it was this grape that people always struggled with. They kind of hated it. They thought it was too green. But there's now this raft of really beautiful aromatic Cabernet Francs, both in I hate making comparisons to France because that takes you down the rabbit hole, but both in what was sort of a Bordelais context, which is these very stately, cellar-worthy wines, as well as what you can call a Loire context, but wines that are simply meant for the table. They're not meant to be big, dramatic, expensive wines. It's why with the top 100, I gave my top sort of Cabernet-based wine to a $28 Cabernet Franc from Santa Ynez Valley. Because I wanted to get the rare chance to choose a Cabernet under $100. But I also wanted to make the point that this is a grape that the West Coast is now really finessed. What else? You know, great Riesling is coming back. You know, American Grüner Veltliner, which is not a thing I expected that I would ever say. There's this amazing diversity, and I think, again, to this point of a maturing culture, the fact that we can look outside of these somewhat narrow columns that we've been operating with for maybe 30 years is, to me, the sign that American wine and California wine specifically has really grown up.
Our thanks to John Bonnet, wine editor for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of the book New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste. We also thank our audiences here on the radio and online. I'm Fred Swan, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.